This is the fourth in the series of Entrepreneurship Matters events. We're very fortunate to have Professor Kubi here tonight with us. We apologize for the delay. I had hoped, actually, that it was people lining up to sort of come to the event, but I think others were prevented from coming, so apologies for the delay. Just a few words about the program. We're on to the second event of this session. We have forthcoming events after this one, so in 2 weeks' time, we have Duncan Clark of the BDA Advisory Organization. He had been involved with the Alibaba IPO advice, so that'll be a fascinating lecture to listen to. We then have Wal Collad of what used to be ISIS until very recently. For obvious reasons, they have changed the name. And then finally, we'll have Lisa Bridget from the luxury online sort of good site, Net-a-Porter. We also have other events which are outside the Entrepreneurship Matters course, but you'll hear more about those, and you're welcome to attend some of those. Now, a reminder again, we started a poll at the last event. The poll is still ongoing. If you'd like to perhaps log in and put your vote in, what we'll do is to report this in about 2 weeks' time, and we'll also have some expert views on the implications of the question and the responses that we'll have extracted. We do have networking events, as you know, after the event. So we have the discussion, we have question and answers, and then the important part of the event over wine is for at least an hour of networking. The team will be here, so do come and tell us how you think the event went, whether you think that there are other things that we might want to stage. We're always happy to speak with you. So now for this evening, we have a talk on entrepreneurship in Africa. Professor Nkubi has given me many a lesson over many years. I think the most memorable one was how to pronounce his name. So I think I've got it right, but I probably need a bit of practice. So Nkubi is a graduate of Cambridge University, where he did his PhD in mathematical finance. He joined the LSE, like very many good people, in 1992, and he was here for 3 years before setting out to South Africa, where he joined Investec. He then became professor of finance at Wits Business School, after which he became dean of Wits Business School, after which he became dean of the Commerce, Law, and Management School, which encompasses the business school at Wits. So a fast-track career in all sorts of complexities to do with academia. I don't think he got tired of that, but he was recruited by the African Development Bank to become its chief economic officer and vice president. Most recently, he's joined the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford. Now, he has numerous sets of achievements, many of which are intellectual and academic, many of which relate to changes in financial institutions. He understands the African context extremely well and is also an investor. So he's going to speak this evening on a variety of areas to do with research, to do with the changing shape of Africa, to do with entrepreneurship opportunities, which is the focus of his talk. And he may also tell us one or two secrets about the sorts of organizations that he's investing in Africa. So join me in welcoming Professor Kubi.
Professor Alno Bimani, an old friend, I just call him Al, and all the colleagues in the LSE Entrepreneurship Initiative, thank you for inviting me. I must also congratulating you in the way you've set up the entire LSE Entrepreneurship Initiative and Center. It's exemplary getting the right type of public discourse going on in a variety of areas in entrepreneurship, but also making sure that the policymakers, real entrepreneurs, can contribute to that debate and then driving the thought leadership in all of that. So I'm going to speak on the subject of entrepreneurship in Africa, looking at the opportunities and challenges. But in doing it, I'll sort of meander around and maybe focus on three things first. One is, what keeps African leaders awake at night in terms of development challenges of which entrepreneurship is a part or should be aware of, and entrepreneurship aware of. Number two, think about Africa in the next 50 years. What will Africa look like in the next 50 years? I've done a lot of work of that. I've done a lot of thinking about that. And then number three, and then try to sort of speak to you about why you should care about Africa as students, as researchers, as entrepreneurs. Why should you care about Africa? And then finally, I guess through maybe the Q&A session, talk about my precise experiences with entrepreneurship in Africa. You know, Africa is a continent of 54 countries. An additional country was created, a couple of years ago, being South Sudan. There may be more created, you never know. You know, some of the countries are small, sometimes you even think unviable, but there we are, 54 countries. So many languages, it's easy to think of it as one Africa, but I tell you, you move from Ghana to Nigeria to Central Africa Republic to Somalia, it's different countries, different cultures, different economies. Everything is different. But we always like to think of it as one. It has its advantages, of course, but also disadvantages. And so leaders in these countries have different challenges, but there's some common theme. There's some common things. And if I had to summarize it in one phrase, I would say what keeps them awake at night is the whole issue of inclusive growth. I repeat, inclusive growth. What do I mean by that? Inclusive growth, really, at the end of the day, is about how to create an environment where, you know, your population, whoever they are, as a leader, have equitable access to opportunity. Equitable access to opportunity. And I can think of four dimensions of it. One, in terms of just the economic opportunity, or what I would call the economic pillar, in terms of the social issues, in terms of the political or institutional issues, and finally, in terms of the spatial issues. Let me explain. You see, in terms of the economic issues, the real challenge in Africa is how to keep the current growth going. How do you sustain it? And that will require ideas about, or strategies about, structural transformation. If the growth in Tanzania is driven by the discovery of natural resources, so is the case in Mozambique, to some extent in Nigeria, how do you diversify the economy so that labor can move from some of those low productivity areas into higher productivity, or from one sector to another? How to structurally transform the economies? That's the only way to sustain growth. Otherwise, it may run aground, frankly. But also, you want to create growth that creates, rather support growth that creates jobs. What you don't want is jobless growth. So wherever I go, leaders are asking me, Mutuli, please, can you help us write a youth employment toolkit? And by the way, I've written one for Nigeria, a youth employment toolkit. It's not easy. And let me see if it's going to work at all. So basically creating, or rather supporting growth that creates jobs, keeps leaders awake at night. They all worry about some form of Arab Spring, or maybe African summer, I don't know what it is, or autumn, you know, this and that. But some form of Arab Spring is a source of concern in sub-Saharan Africa, and they worry about that. So, but also, let me say this, they worry about inequality. You know what, if you do the following, if you take GDP growth for Botswana or South Africa, multiply that by this is GDP per capita, by the way. Yeah. Just take GDP per capita. Simple. Okay. Multiply that by 1 minus the Gini coefficient, right? And then see where those two countries are then ranked in terms of rankings of per capita incomes. Because initially these are high per capita income countries, but the moment you inequality adjust your GNP, GDP per capita, they fall to the middle and sometimes bottom. And this is, so we have to think differently about how we use these
GNP per capita figures, any economics, you know, development costs here, the LSE. Try to inequality adjust, you'll find different results. So inequality is important. It bothers leaders a lot. I can tell you that. Let me press on to the second pillar, which is social inclusion. It's about gender equity. It's about making sure that the poor are not left behind. One of the biggest issues around gender equity in Africa is just access to entrepreneurial assets by women. And that has to do with some cultural impediments. So when we are promoting entrepreneurship, and trying to get women into entrepreneurship, if that is the strategy, you have to think about that, all the cultural impediments. Some of them are religious impediments. As an example, social inclusion also includes ethnic issues. It's quite true that in some countries where you've got inequality, you'll find that there's been a ethnic capture of opportunity by a specific ethnic elite. I can think of countries, some of you come from Africa, I don't want to offend anyone, just in case you come from that ethnic group, but I can tell you, I can pinpoint the countries one by one. I know which ethnic group dominates, how does that impact on inequality, the control of opportunity. Those are some of the social issues. And three institutional or political inclusion. Basically, you want to create institutions that are able to define rules of the game that are inclusive to everyone. Everyone can take advantage of opportunity. Political processes that result in fair outcomes of elections. I've studied all the elections in Africa since 1960. Presidential, parliamentary, looking at who won, who lost, who was violent, who cheated, was there a coalition government, and what drives those outcomes. And it's quite clear that elections can be a point of inflection in the construction of the apex institution in Africa, which is government, and we have to be wary of that. Most coups take place just before an election, or maybe during, maybe just after. So these are important points of inflection to worry about, and it can keep us awake at night. Finally, a spatial inclusion. If you study inequality, you'll find that a big driver of inequality is spatial inequality, the divide between urban, rural, you know, that kind of thing. And in this case, I'm going to transition to infrastructure gap as a big concern in Africa, because that's what you do to connect urban and rural areas, is to build roads to make sure that those become one pieces of environment for living, because they are connected efficiently through infrastructure. So building infrastructure in Africa is one way to deal with spatial inclusion. Africa has a gap of something like $50 billion a year of infrastructure that goes unfunded, $50 billion. In aid, Africa receives overall maybe something like order of $60, $65 billion in all of aid covering everything. And I'm saying that $50 billion additional should be going to infrastructure, but it is not coming, it's not there. So this is a big issue, and I must say that for leaders and you as entrepreneurs, you should think about what I call inclusive infrastructure. It's very important. The moment you talk about infrastructure investment, people think that it's not poverty reducing. That is not true. That is not true. You know, I've traveled through a few roads that I helped finance when I was at the African Development Bank, and trying to find out if they were truly inclusive or not. You know how you make a road inclusive? You build feeder roads along it. What they do is they attract the communities along that road. I tell you, if you do that, you will turn a road into an economy. In Africa, a road is an economy. I've seen regions in Africa where development just springs up just because we put a road through. That's all. If I always give the example of Rwanda, because for me that's the most vivid one, where is a road somewhere between Kigali and the border with Burundi, is about a 60-kilometer road, and that was the poorest region before, like 5 years ago, very poor. Now there's a road. Everything has changed. Property prices have gone up. Little towns are coming up all over the place along the entire road. trading. Children are going to school. Why? Because you feed a road. Mothers can get to the clinic. Why? Because you feed a road. It transforms a poor region into a less poor region. So infrastructure is an economy. A road is an economy. Infrastructure is critical. I talked earlier about achieving structural transformation, making sure the growth creates jobs. You know what keeps leaders awake at night in that respect is the demographics. Africa is going to add another 1 billion people in the next 50 years. The population is going to double, at least, absolutely. Right? So lots of youth milling about looking for opportunity. It could be a nightmare, it could be an opportunity, who knows? But that's a lot of people. Now, the opportunity, of course, is that's the future labor force of the world, in the sense that if wages are rising in China, where should those productive Chinese factories be settling? Maybe in Africa. I'm really warmed up by this story in Ethiopia, this Chinese company called Huanjin, which is, I'm sure some of you know this story already, I'm probably repeating. Well, manufacturing shoes. Why are they doing it in Ethiopia? Lots of cattle, lots of leather, no brainer. So shoe factory. And now they're employing at least 1,000 Ethiopians, and the level of productivity of the Ethiopian workers is about 80% that of their Chinese colleagues. It's just gone up because of training and so forth. So it can be done. In other words, it can be done. So a factory locating from China to Africa, and it works. So some of those shoes, Gucci shoes or something that we are buying, they are actually made in Ethiopia. I'm sure, without saying so. So the demographic dividend needs to be harnessed. That's a challenge. It's also an opportunity for entrepreneurs. The other issue is health. Again, looking at the demographics, if Ebola can wreak so much havoc, imagine you have 1 billion more people, and then in the health systems are still weak, which is the issue, by the way. The epidemic broke out in regions where health systems are weak because these were post-conflict economies in the Manu region of Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. So health is a big issue, and trying to get that right. Talk about entrepreneurship. I still chair a hospital in Bulawayo in the south of Zimbabwe, which I got involved about 15 years ago. Of course, the economy up and down in Zimbabwe and so forth and so forth. So, but I still stayed on as chair of the hospital. It's a private, it's a PPP, and so forth. And I agreed to do that because, you realize that the health sector challenge is just right across the spectrum. It's about health sector policy, different types of diseases. It's about getting the institutions, the hospitals right. Training lots of nurses, half of them are lost to the UK because of higher wages. It's a complicated area, and that's why I thought, let me get involved in this. And now we're trying to turn the hospital into an orthopedic hospital for children, and then one part of it for cancer treatment and so forth. So a bit of entrepreneurship in the health sector. Education, again with the demographics that I painted, the need for the right type of educations are there, they are real. Time to see whether we can use mobile telephony to deliver courses is something that I've been kind of experimenting with. It's not easy. So that we can reach out to because of the penetration of mobile telephony, as many people as possible, but education is going to be an issue. Good work on the last MDGs. We're now waiting for the SDGs, but you know what? We increased primary school enrollment, so it looks like a very nice MDG. Everything is achieved and so forth, but no one is checking the quality of the kids. They can't read properly. They can't write properly. They can't do science properly. They can't add and subtract properly. So there's a problem with the quality and then no one tells you about the dropout rate. By the way, huge dropout rate. One of the things I'm trying to do on my entrepreneurship front privately is to see how I can use mobile phone technology to improve teacher attendance. Some of you may know what is called iBeacons, which is sort of a near field communication. That little thing like that, stick it on a wall.
It talks to you once your mom, your smartphone comes to within 300 meters of it. So we can feed advertising material through that, charge you for it. Nothing is for free. But imagine that if you put it in a school, and any teacher who comes into the school, it will know that he or she has come in or not, so that I can start tracking teacher absenteeism. At the moment I said that to someone, he said, oh, but what if a teacher comes in and then they leave their phone and then walk out of the school? So it might just happen, you know, but I think it would tell me if the teacher moved or not. So real geolocation. I've just given an example, and I hope I can make money from that enterprise. We'll see. Another matter that is of real interest to leaders that keeps them awake and alive is the whole issue of regional integration. How do you integrate 54 countries and make them work? How do you create a bigger market out of that? I've said some of the countries are so small, maybe they're not viable, you know, really small. So they need to be integrated. How do you, and integration is a very complex issue. There's the issue of building regional institutions of excellence, be they learning, recognition of, you know, of qualifications across countries, lawyers and doctors in different countries. There's issue of just infrastructure, making sure that one-stop border posts are there and they work so that people can move across, goods can move between countries easily. It's a complex issue. It's not just about the trade in goods, you know. It's a much more holistic issue. In some parts of Africa, it's about building institutions for military intervention when there are problems politically. It's also part of it. Without that regional intervention, you cannot create a market. So it keeps leaders awake at night, and as an entrepreneur, be aware of that. I'm now beginning to see leaders worry about climate change. I must say this. In Africa, the moment you mention climate change, green this, green growth, leaders get slightly uncomfortable. I never know why, but climate change is real. I don't know how many of you know anything about Lake Chad. Is anyone from that part of the region, Lake Chad, Central Africa? Lake Chad.
It's gone missing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's gone missing. It's one lake that has almost disappeared during our lifetime. In 1983, it was there. In 2015, it's almost gone. Why? Because of, you know, the way the community has managed its, you know, animals in terms of how they drink water from there, desertification, you know, Sahel encroachment, all manner of environmental things have impacted, and the lake is disappearing. So there are some environmental issues, and someone has actually said to me, says, whenever you're thinking of all the conflicts in the Sahel region, in Mali and so forth, don't discount the environmental pressures. They are part of the reasons why you have the flare-ups in Mali or wherever, Tuaregs and so forth. There's an issue with the climate. So in the next 50 years, what will Africa look like? I've talked about 1 billion extra people in terms of the demographics. I've talked about the emergence of bigger cities. Urbanization is taking place. It's the fastest urbanizing continent in the world. At the moment, we've got about 40% of Africans living in cities. In about 50 years' time, it's going to be, 60% of the population living in cities. Imagine the pressure in those cities. Imagine the opportunity, though, if you're in the infrastructure development business or you're in the housing sector, you know, building houses and so forth. Fabulous opportunity exists in those cities. Also, what you see is just in terms of the size of the economy, it's going to go something like 15 trillion. US dollars, that's the expectation. And GDP per capita is going to move from something like $2,000 per capita to more like $7,000 per capita. So there's going to be quite a huge increase, in terms of the size of the African economies and the population. Imagine then the opportunity of the growing middle class. I've just published a book on the emerging middle class in Africa. And this middle class is growing at 3.2% per annum. So it is there. It is growing. The moment I said middle class, someone said, middle class in Africa? Forget. It doesn't exist. But it exists, I can tell you. Most of the children of the elite in Africa, the middle class, you find them in schools here in the UK, in the US, and everywhere. They come to university. Some of them are at the LSE.
Some of you have scholarships, but I should take that back. But I know that children of the middle class source their education from outside. If you look at poverty, I've done another study last year on the dynamics of poverty until year 2030, looking at it country by country where poverty is likely to be in year 2030. Poverty is going to reduce, but not fast enough, because growth is not inclusive enough, quote unquote. There are countries where poverty remains stubborn, like, for instance, Congo, DRC, Central African Republic, remain quite high. But in a place like Ethiopia or Rwanda, major achievements in poverty reduction. I've seen some of the forecasts from the World Bank of about a target of 3% extreme poverty levels by year 2030. Africa, at best, will achieve 15% overall. And this is if you assume that you had a Swedish-type level of equality, you know, if you assume that you have Chinese, the old Chinese growth, 10%, not the current one of 6.8%. If you assume nirvana, Africa can only achieve poverty levels of 15%, which is still way below Asia and this kind of target. So there's still challenges, but there'll be a drop in poverty, I can assure you. Now, you will see also over time the emergence of, let me call it the South or the BRIC countries, begin to trade more with Africa over time, China, Brazil, India, and so forth. You will see within Africa itself also a lot more trading taking place, and you might just shift in that direction. Now, let me transition to a third area, which is why you should care about Africa. How am I doing for time? Right. My timekeeper is very generous, but I know and I feel it when I'm running out of time. A few points about why you should care about Africa. Well, if you're a student of economics or development economics or whatever, development studies, even politics, I mean, right across the social sciences, or even in a business school, you know, you should care about Africa because that's, in my view, that's the laboratory of development policies. Anything that's got to do with development, trying to get things right economically, you can experiment in Africa. It's a good, I'm not saying that going to experiment. I'm saying that what's really going on is a laboratory of what could go wrong or go right. So just intellectually, you must care about Africa. You must care about how different programs for development could work or not, and so forth. Also, obviously, it's a source of opportunity. If you've got 1 billion people coming through, that's a lot of people. If I were you, I would be there, thinking of where I can make money. It's not easy, but go for it anyway. I try to do that successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully. But also, you should care because this is where some of the future workers of the world will come from. Maybe better get there before these guys come out and compete with you. It's going to be a lot of people, as I say, if half of the 1 billion extra people is young, they are quite a formidable labor force. But let me say this. Something needs to be done about reforming some of the African labor markets, because in some countries, actually, labor is expensive relative to productivity. So there's an issue about upgrading the skills of the African labor force for them to be competitive. So more work needs to be invested, or rather work needs to be put in making sure that the skills are upgraded, and maybe through vocational education and other tactics, that needs to be done. Of course, needless to say that with this kind of demographics, size of growth, in terms of the quantum of GDP leap, Africa is a market, you know. Middle class. So you should care about Africa. So I hope that I've painted a picture that will illuminate your entrepreneurial thinking, the opportunities, and I'm happy to go deeper into entrepreneurship, maybe during the Q&A, but whenever you ask questions. On that note, thank you very much.
Okay, that was a very, very interesting talk. And a microcosm of the sorts of things I think that Mathuli writes about. Now, I've been reading some of your writings, and one of the things that struck me is that you talk about hard and soft infrastructural changes. And I'm wondering how much of that would you sort of pinpoint towards African entrepreneurs requiring more finance? Because right now it's pretty thin on the ground. Banks don't seem to provide it, and stock markets are pretty sort of
thin. You're right. I think the way to think about infrastructure in Africa is really through hard and soft infrastructure, and to an extent inclusive infrastructure. So basically, hard infrastructure, put it simply, is your road. The soft infrastructure is maybe a one-stop border post through which this road passes to the next country. Or it could be about port management systems in a port, which is in itself hard infrastructure. So a combination of those two is almost always what you need to make the infrastructure effective in delivering the services that it ought to deliver. And entrepreneurs, whether they're in the IT sector, in terms of port systems management, or in managing one-stop border posts, there's greater opportunity. If you think of opportunities in the energy sector, huge opportunities. Right now, you could go and establish a solar farm in Morocco, and eventually you make money. You could go and establish another wind farm in Cape Verde. Choose the right area where the wind is strong, But I must say that a good part of Cape Verde, there's good strong winds, I must say. And again, you make money. So there's opportunities everywhere. The one that really excites me is, I shouldn't mention the town, because then I'll be giving away the project. I would say a big, crowded city in Africa where I'm trying to assist someone to introduce cable cars, because it's so crowded. But if you introduce cable cars, and I inspected the roads, look at the roads, Al, you already have the middle part. Cars go this way, some come that way. There's a middle class where you've got the poles that with lights that illuminate the road. So you don't have to do anything. So if you just enhance those poles, you build further up, you can run your zip line, and the cable car is up and running. I worked it out that the cost of that, at least for that part of the route, something like $150 million. If we were to expand that road to take more cars and move more people or build a railway line, you spend $1.5 billion. So easily for 10% of the cost, you could just innovate. It's green, But someone said, what happens if there's a power cut? So I said, well, just invest in two helicopters to bring them down. So great opportunity, innovation. There's a lot you can do in Africa.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Now, you hinted that at the extent of urbanization that's ongoing, which is probably the fastest on the globe, that's changing the shape of Africa. I think you say in your book, in about 15 years' time, half of Africa will be living in cities. But the other transformational change is in effect, not just urbanization, but the extent to which you're going to see a growth in the middle classes, around a tripling in the next three and a half decades. What sorts of opportunities are there? And are they just opportunities, or is there a potential for losing a lot of money if you're an entrepreneur?
Yeah, you could lose money, or make lots of it. It's called risk-taking. As long as you are being rewarded from time to time of the risk you take, it's okay. I mean, urbanization, which, by the way, goes along with middle-class growth, it presents a great opportunity. I mean, think about it in terms of just urban housing. I've been trying to even figure out, working with other people as well, how we can establish a mortgage finance company in Nigeria. Because what happens in a lot of these countries is that the housing is funded through the bank. Either you've got the cash, to build your own house or buy your own house, or you go, for a short-term loan in a bank, from a bank, and try to buy your house that way. It can't work like that. You need long-term financing. So the institutions for long-term funding are missing. So to me, that's a great opportunity. But I must say that it's not an easy one to take, because what you would need some kind of change in the regulatory environment.
First of all, you need the long-term investors in the first place. So you need pension fund reform for that to take place. So there's a bit of hard work, spade work to do before you get to the mortgage finance company. But all that can be done with the right policy advice and the policymakers putting that in place. And then eventually you could do that. So, and then just build houses out, because that's what the urban areas need, good housing. Investing in the road system. I look at how, who was last in Nairobi a few months ago? You were there. You know that Tika Road?
Yeah.
Yeah, Tika Road. That road has transformed a part of Nairobi. You know? Yeah. Congestion is down. You know, and the African Development Bank is making money out of that road because it's a profitable, you know, road, and so that's the opportunity. I think of the what's the other road in Senegal, the one that's going to lead to the new airport. Has anyone seen that? We also build that at the African Development Bank. You know, again, all that is profitable. There's so many other toll roads everywhere. Which again present opportunity for entrepreneurs, and in the urban areas, and that again is a great opportunity. But also urban areas are where you're likely to locate factories. So in terms of just looking for employment, that's where jobs are likely to be found. That is also where you should think of building, you know, education institutions. Think of building hospitals, you know, privately owned hospitals. A few months ago, just before I left the bank, remember we approved the development of a private hospital in the Gambia. It was the first privately owned hospital from the Gambia, spearheaded by a Scottish-trained Gambian doctor in the diaspora. I was very excited about that project. I really fought hard for it to make sure that it goes through the board. You want private entrepreneurs to be involved in healthcare. In hospitals. I mean, there are just so many opportunities that urbanization presents: housing, services, the jobs. I mean, it's just incredible. And we, like any middle class, they consume. You know, food manufacturing, food processing. The middle class consumes, and they live in the urban areas. So there's just so much, you know, to exploit.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll open up now for questions. Well, you had your hand up first, so we'll go ahead with you.
Thanks, Atul. That was
Atul Shah, Suffolk Business School. That was fascinating. I was born and raised in Kenya, so I can relate to some of the things you're saying. Thuli, you spoke about growth in many times during your talk today. But you didn't really define growth. And are you speaking about growth from the typical Western model of growth, which is around consumerism and inequality as a part of growth? And what? And actually, also when you brought in the subject of the environment, it was as if, you know, we should deal with the environment because it's hurting in certain places, rather than a kind of new model of growth, a growth model which is very African in its cultural context and its fundamental ethos. And of course, that means also, you see, you're an entrepreneur, so you see urbanization as an opportunity. But urbanization, of course, we know is a choke, you know, is almost like a stranglehold on society, right? So. Is there too much of economics dominating your vision for Africa, and too little of culture and ethics and sustainability? Thank you.
Right. Oh, I'm taking it.
Three
or
two?
One at a time. Oh, I said three at a time. Is it on? Okay. Thank you. Good advice there. Well, as I said, Atul, I talked about inclusive growth, not just growth. Inclusive growth it goes beyond GDP growth. As I said, it includes just the economic GDP growth. It includes issues around inequality, making sure that inequality is dealt with as growth takes place. It includes spatial issues, spatial inclusion. It includes social inclusion. It includes institutional stroke political inclusion. So there are four pillars to inclusive growth that I refer to, and that's what keeps leadership awake in Africa. That's what should keep anyone awake. So it's not just simple GDP economic growth. It's much broader than that. Some people will say, the moment I talk about inclusive growth this way, people say, oh, but why not call it sustainable growth? I mean, there's so many terms people use and so forth. But in my view, this is how I look at it. Greening the economy or the environment is a new model. I agree with you. That's why I mentioned the issue of solar farms in Morocco, for instance, or geothermal energy in Kenya is an opportunity. Wind farms in Lake Turkana in Kenya, your country, your former country, country of birth, and then wind farms in Cape Verde and in South Africa. All those are green projects, green opportunities that people are able to realize economic opportunity from. And in my view, it constitutes maybe a new model in terms of how to green economies and make money out of it and realize opportunity out of it and solve an infrastructure gap out of. It's not always a problem. It's an opportunity. But it can be a problem if you've got the Lake Chad problem, which is what I mentioned. If you've got the Sahel encroachment, one of the things we tried to do in a part of the Sahel region was to try to grow a green belt to stop the encroachment of the desert. It's just not easy. And trying to incentivize people not to cut down trees in the Congo, it's not easy. People are cutting down trees and so forth and creating a sustainable environment. So yeah, it's an opportunity. It's a new model, but also we should be wary of destroying this. I think my notion of inclusive growth is sufficiently broad. It's not just economic.
Yeah, but it's thank you, Matthew.
I'm sorry.
It's anthropocentric. It's all about humans, and humans are only one of the species on this planet.
Well,
okay. Well, let's move on to.
I nearly answered, so I'm leaving.
Hello. Yeah. Professor, thank you for your speech. My name is Francisco. I study a master's in public administration at the LSE. I wanted to ask you, what's your view on social entrepreneurship? Many exponents like Mohamed Yunus tell us that it's probably one of the solutions for development and for poverty around the world. What is your view on it in Africa? And do you think the governments should help social entrepreneurship? Or it should be entirely a private matter? Thank you.
Oh, I think that there is a private-public partnership opportunity in social entrepreneurship. I think governments must promote it, support it, and it should be encouraged. I mean, if you look at what Yunus Mohamed has done with the whole idea of the Grameen Bank, it's fabulous. At the African Development Bank, I worked closely with him on this concept of social business. I even invited him to come and talk to the managers to begin to see things differently. And we put in $1 million US dollars in one of the initiatives. I totally support this. I mean, think about it. The M-Pesa success story in mobile banking is a commercial, viable project and idea, makes money. It has really created Equity Bank, if you think about it. Made lots of money also for Safaricom, the mobile company in Kenya. But also, it's also social entrepreneurship. It has solved one problem, which is social inclusion. And you see it being replicated in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, parts of the Congo, DRC, in Ghana, in Nigeria. Everywhere you begin to see this being replicated. I try to push hard for it. To go into Nigeria, and I think perhaps the authorities were a lot more kind of reticent, because the moment you talk about mobile banking, central bankers can't deal with it. I think they have to think hard and say, how does it impact on monetary policy? What happened to money supply, velocity of money, 1/V? You know that from your MV is equal to PY in your economics classes. They worry about that, then they get thoroughly confused. So, but in my view, as long as you have got the marriage between a bank and a mobile telephone company, it works because central banks regulates the bank and all the transactions, as long as the systems also feed into each other. It's not a big problem for monetary policy. But there it is. It's a business. It's an idea. But it's also social entrepreneurship. The thing I was mentioning about using iBeacons for instance, tracking teacher attendance, this is social entrepreneurship. And I was speaking to the Gauteng government in South Africa for us to partner and work together to make it work. Of course, all the teachers don't like it. The teacher unions don't like it. But I'm determined that we should press on with this. The other thing is just using the mobile telephone, because one of the things I do at Oxford is I manage a project on HIV pandemic, looking at the new economics for HIV. I can talk for ages about that as well, but don't start me, but I'm happy to do that. So looking at how, for instance, you could increase getting people tested for HIV and trying to ask them private questions by mobile phone, sending them text messages and so forth. All those are social entrepreneurship ideas. I could go on and on. By the way, I've written a book called Silicon Kenya. Look out for it, where I try to document all the wonderful innovations. I've used Kenya, but it's really the whole of Africa in terms of social entrepreneurship, but also hard-nosed commercial entrepreneurship. So long answer to a short question.
Thank you. Yes, Carol.
Could you give us an example in your long experience of working with those who resist change? For example, I think it's a fantastic idea. Anyone who's been stuck in a traffic jam in a major city in a developing nation and how hard it is to get back to the airport. Cable cars, fantastic, but what about the special interests? The car owners, the car sellers, the taxi drivers, those little bus guys that go put. They aren't necessarily going to embrace the idea of cable cars. In your role in the African Development Bank, how did you deal with these special interests that would get in the way of change?
You're right. You have special interests everywhere. I remember when we started speaking about this idea of cable cars, we had to talk to the Taxi Drivers Association. And the way forward, make them shareholders in the cable car business. Just make them shareholders. Negotiate something with them. Get them on board. End of story. Yeah. Then, yeah, absolutely. I can give more examples. In some of the mining projects that we funded, where we are acutely aware that the company we are financing will have difficulties exploiting the minerals, I say to them, look, you can do one of two things. Create a community trust, which will fund visible projects for the benefit of the community, and or make sure the trust is a shareholder in the company. The community has to benefit from that. There are many examples in which you can create really inclusive models for driving some of this kind of growth and solving long-term development projects. And it works. It actually works. I'm actually amazed sometimes at how greedy companies are, oil companies. Yet I think it's all simple. If the communities are shareholders, 10%, 15%, it works.
Okay, I'm not sure. Thank you.
quiz it is, because it's a security thing.
Okay.
You made progress.
Thank you.
Are we evacuating?
We will assess the situation. If there is an opportunity to come back, we will let you know.
Hello.
Okay,
it's a false alarm.
All sit down again.
So you can all take your seats, folks. Don't worry. It's a false alarm.
Okay. Apologies for this. We'll have the lady just over there, and the roving mic is on its way to you.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Hi, good evening. My question has to do with inequality. Inequality. So we talk about, you were talking about the urban areas, the green urbanizations and urbanization and the need for private sector players to step in for service provision in education, health and other services. So my concern is that you have migrants in these urban areas and other low-income earners that may not be able to afford to pay for the services by private sector providers. How can you mitigate, how can the potential inequality that would develop be mitigated with the influx of private sector players?
I'm made to think here of some of the slums that I see in Cape Town or in Johannesburg, and just to whether people can afford the services exactly, because of they migrate from the rural areas or indeed from other countries and settle there. But this is where government comes in. I mean, there's a role for government in making sure that those vulnerable groups in the urban areas don't create dangerous slums. They're able to receive electricity. Certainly some of these areas have been, wired up in terms of electricity provision. Water has been provided. So it's all subsidized. So at the end of the day, you do need this public-private partnership between the private sector, which may be providing some of the services, and government providing some form of subsidy to make things work. That's the only way until they're able to, be gainfully employed or be entrepreneurs and they'll be able to afford tariffs themselves on their own. Whenever the bank was rolling out an electricity project, I would always ask, what's the tariff that's going to be charged at the end of all of this? And that's where the shoe pinches at the end of the day, because without the right tariff level, then the power project may not be viable. And if you think of the transmission in between. So you always need to subsidize at the bottom end of the pyramid. There's no question about that.
Thank you. Yeah, you've had your hand up for a while, so please go ahead.
Thank you. We cannot talk of an African entrepreneurship without intra-African trade. But as you might know, there is a problem. Just yesterday, the East African community released a report and trade between Uganda and Kenya has reduced by over 20% in just 1 month.
Reduced, what are you saying?
Yes, reduced. And why? Because getting the same good from China to Uganda is cheaper than getting the same good from Kenya to Uganda, who are neighboring countries. So at the African Development Bank, how do you see this challenge? I think it's the biggest challenge to Africa's entrepreneurship. Thank you.
It's a very, very good question. The answer is multifaceted. The Chinese goods are cheaper because, again, of lower labor costs. That's why I really emphasize the point about African labor relative to productivity being quite expensive. Kenyan workers are very expensive compared to Chinese workers for the same good.
Even though in terms of transportation, it's a longer distance, obviously, from whatever province of China the goods are being produced compared to Nairobi, which is next door to Uganda. So clearly, it's got to do with productivity, cost of production. I had the core of this. You know, it really goes back to the whole issue of structural transformation that I tried to explain using the Ethiopia example. If you don't get structural transformation in Africa, which will result in a growing manufacturing sector, trade within Africa will remain limited. That's the problem. It's really the size of the manufacturing sector is still small, but also then also lies the opportunity. You've got countries that are just mining sector dominated, and you don't have the manufacturing sector doing other things to accompany that sector. But also, the mining sector doesn't create jobs. There's a lot more jobs created by industries around mining. Think of cluster industries around mining. Those are really sources of jobs. But manufacturing is the issue. Whenever you're setting up a factory anywhere, you have to think of the power supply. Is my power reliable? Or will I end up investing in generators half the time, which is very, very expensive electricity? Does the infrastructure exist? Do the skills exist? When you talk to the mobile telephony providers, if you ask them what's the biggest impediment to your business, they won't tell you it's regulatory because they've all dealt with that. They already have a license. They say it's finding the skills, the engineers to employ and do the work. So that's what is going on there in terms of Africa versus China in that trade space. And growing manufacturing.
Thank you, Mathuli. The lady over there. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Annie Ripoy-Sarraga. I'm an auditor and I teach accounting in the business school. My question is regarding the 50 years, where Africa will be in 50 years' time. And precisely, I would like to ask your vision regarding where do you think Africa could be if the external debt is eradicated? So in other words, why the worldwide economies don't want to forgive the external debt? Thank you.
Right now, actually, external debt in Africa is not the big elephant in the room. It's not the big issue. If you look at debt to GDP levels, they are averaging in the 40% zone very easily after the HIPIC initiative and all the Jubilee 2000 debt forgiveness initiatives. Only a few countries are sitting with high debt to GDP levels on the external front. Is Sudan, is Zimbabwe. Well, a few are beginning to show higher debt levels. You know, Ghana close to 60%, Gambia, Zambia hitting 55%. But it's under control. That is not the issue. Of course, it doesn't mean that they have to relax. I think the issue is how do you maintain that and make sure that the macro fundamentals remain strong. I spent a good part of the 2 years working closely with the Ghana government trying to get macro fundamentals right. And I mean, this is public knowledge. So we know one of the biggest problems is wages. That you have the wage bill in Ghana, which is huge. And what's really happening is that you find that, what hasn't been sorted out is some of the ghost workers in government or indeed people who work maybe for political parties being paid through the government coffers and so forth. But all that it requires is fixing the constitution. So it is do it through the front door where, workers from different political parties are properly dealt with through, budget allocations, through constitutional means in terms of the number of parliamentary seats that a specific party has won. These models work through the front door. It shouldn't be done through the kind of back door. And that's the driver. So what it has done is expenditure has gone through the roof. Obviously, it means that in terms of your domestic interest rates, look at the T-bill rates, 90-day, they've all shot up. You look at that is impacting, obviously, the currency side of things, because once you've got your imbalances on the domestic side, suddenly they move on to your external side. It's hurting
the cedi, it has depreciated quite a bit. So there's some macroeconomic imbalances, the core of which has been just the domestic management of some of these issues. But debt is not the problem at the moment. But let me say this, there are some implicit debts. If you look at the liability from HIV, if you want to treat all the people who are on antiretrovirals in Africa now, keep them alive, treat them. Of course, more will be added, you know, because of people. There's some non-zero incidents. You are looking at easily over the next 35 years, Africa needs something like $800 billion for treatment and prevention on HIV. It's a lot of money. It's an implicit debt. In fact, I'm looking at the debt for Botswana. If we were to add the cost of treatment over the next 35 years, doing a present value of that and add it to the current stock of external debt, suddenly a country with low debt levels of order of about 18%, it jumps by another 12% very easily. So all I'm saying is that while the explicit debt in terms of IMF accounting is under control, there's also so much implicit debt to worry about.
Thank you, Mathuli. Gentleman right at the top.
Thank you. In order to improve the entrepreneurship in Africa, which indicator for you is more important? Infrastructure, that you said that infrastructure is very important, or maybe human capital for the all the science and technology that in Africa is doing, or the third is corruption. I mean, for me, it's corruption. For example, in Latin America, the problem is accountability and corruption because a lot of money is coming to Latin America or maybe to Africa. But what about corruption and then accountability in the government?
You know what? If you want to know where you should do business, at least where you're likely to be successful, just take a look at the doing business indicators from the World Bank, run by the IFC. It's a good starting point because it will deal with your infrastructure needs, the cost of doing business in the country, human capital, stock, corruption issues. The speed in which you can set up a company, property rights indicators, there'll be so many indicators out age that's where you should start. And the one country that has improved the most, by the way, in terms of doing business rankings is Rwanda. And it's, I must admit, it's one of my favorite countries. That's why I always want to do business if I can. But you're right, corruption is something that you should worry about. You should always say no to corruption. Do not pay those bribes. We'd rather walk away, and go somewhere else, frankly. The human capital issue, you might have to think long term. I mean, you may have to invest in it yourself. If you need people to do things in your company, you have to invest in them. You have to look hard, but prepare to invest in them. Maybe you can't do much about the infrastructure unless you want to be an infrastructure entrepreneur yourself. Usually then it's the government that has to do that. But for a good guide, just look at the doing business indicators. It has got a myriad of indicators, and all of them are very important for choosing where to go.
Thank you, Mathuli. Gentlemen.
Thank you for the talk. I'm Sean, a management student at LSE. I'm from Tanzania. I was just wondering, you mentioned that there was a gap in the real estate development market in terms of providers of long-term lending, and you mentioned maybe institutional investors such as pension funds. I was wondering if such a provider would enter the market, how would they keep interest rates low? Because I think banks, they offer very high interest rates on their lending, and as an entrepreneur, I think getting access to funding is quite a challenge in East Africa, at least. So what are your views on this?
I know about the controversies over the high interest rates in Kenya. I'm sure you have followed that. There's a reason why they are that high. The spreads, I mean, Africa, compare the deposit rate to the lending rate, huge. You can drive a truck through it. That's where the money is. There are many reasons. Part of it has to do with, for a long time, traditional high budget deficits, so which meant that banks, you know, had to lend to government, and the high inflation levels thereof in terms of government spending, which was driving inflation, that led to high interest rates because central banks have to keep real interest rates positive to deal with inflation. So if you go into a typical bank, you find that there's a large holding of treasury bills. Why? It's easy money. But in some countries, it's compulsory for banks to buy treasury bills. You have to. But also, treasury bills become a way of dealing with collateral within the banking system. So I could go on and on about that. So that's one of the reasons why rates are high. So it's got to do with the public sector finances. Number two, it's also got to do with collateral. Because if banks are unsure about your collateral standing, they just charge you more in interest so they can recoup their money faster. You know, just think of the longer interest rate versus another interest rate from HSBC. There's a big difference, and the difference is a sense of collateral and credit worthiness. So it reflects credit worthiness, but also the ability to resolve any default and recuperate whatever they you owe them. Can the courts enforce that? So contract enforceability is also priced into the high interest rates. But my view is this. I think that if you can introduce more competition in Tanzania, in Kenya, and East Africa, in the mortgage market, I think eventually rates will come down. There will be competition in the financial sector, and I think rates will come down. So I'm not in favor, though, of some of the initiatives you hear about, oh, we should cap interest rates. I'm sure you had that kind of debate. It's a bad idea, I think, because banks will always find a way to make sure that you still pay them what you owe them. There are ways around this. You'll find maybe collateral requirements suddenly go up, or I don't know. So I think the interest rate offer a lucrative way into that business if you want to go into it, but the competition, I think, eventually will drive rates down.
Thank you, Mathuli. The lady just three seats up. Yes.
Hello, good evening. My name is Amir Deng. I'm a recent graduate of the International Relations Department at the LSE, and I'm now working here in the Student Recruitment Office. I wonder if you could shed some thoughts on a few things. Firstly, on what the African Development Bank has done to foster corridors to Africa and pathways to Africa for members of the diaspora and for those who are pan and pro-Africa. Secondly, on if you consider building Africa as a marketplace, on the chicken and egg dilemma. And then lastly, on historic economies, such as the dowry economy. How would, I'd like if you would share some thoughts on those, please.
Last one is more difficult. I don't know much about that, to be honest. But perhaps building corridors, absolutely. The African Development Bank has got a regional integration strategy. And corridors are part of that strategy, making sure that this becomes hubs of economic activity. And most of these corridors would lead to some kind of port or something like that, connecting various countries. We have that in East Africa. For instance, we've been looking at this whole idea of the Lamu port idea, the Maputo corridor in Mozambique, upgrading the road. I think now we're on to our third upgrade of that Maputo corridor road. There's a project which I've seen recently on an oil depot, for instance, in Namibia, and Windhoek, and trying to then develop a corridor from that. So the countries that are in the hinterland can use that as a depot for their oil. There's just so much going on, all driven by this regional integration strategy. I can't say much about the traditional economies, I must say, but in building markets, the bank's view is that at the end of the day, if we can connect African countries together through infrastructure, through building institutions, that's a fabric that you need to put in place to build a bigger market, a common market. But at the end of the day, you know, it has to be driven by the RECs, the regional economic communities, East Africa Community, the Rand Monetary Area, ECOWAS, and then in the north. I'm baffled by the small, minute intra-Maghreb trade between Egypt, Tunisia,
Morocco, Libya. We don't know what to do about that. It's the least integrated region in Africa, because why? Every country in that part of the region of Africa is looking towards Europe. How do you, you know, become effective for Italy, for France, for, you know, rather than among themselves? So those are some of the challenges. But that's what the bank is trying to do, at least in you know, creating a bigger market in Africa through different strategies.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. Okay, we'll take one last question. The lady at the top over there who's had her hand up. Yes,
Yeah, thank you very much for your talk. My name is Franziska. I'm from Germany. I'm doing my master's here. My question comes back to entrepreneurship, and I wanted to ask you what you would think of non-Africans coming to Africa and doing entrepreneurship there, whether it being social or not. But do you believe in that? Would you think it's helpful or appreciated, or would you rather say that there should be African solutions for African problems?
Well, entrepreneurship opportunities, in my view, should be open to everyone. And I think that there's real value in Africans on the ground partnering with non-Africans from other regions, especially if they bring different skills, different experiences, might open Africa to new markets and so forth. It's a damn idea. I'm a big champion of joint ventures everywhere, because I think that's the way to go. I mean, where, you know, Africans can do it themselves, fine, they should get on with it. But I don't think that it should be a policy that non-Africans cannot invest, they cannot come in. I think there should be a more positive narrative about the contribution of joint ventures between locals and foreigners as something positive, I think. You cannot, you know, run away from globalization. That's what it means. It means, you know, people partnering and working together for joint prosperity.
Thank you, Mathuli. Do join me in thanking.